From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Duff McKagan is my guest, along with his music career, has been writing for SeattleWeekly.com. He did a weekly financial column for Playboy called Duffonomics, Guns N' Roses, Velvet Revolver, Loaded, even a stint with Jane's Addiction. And I was looking a little bit into your biography. You were a full-time student at Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics. You're still one semester short of the...
Go Red Hawks. Velvet Revolver... started right in my senior year at Seattle U. I went there for my I woke up at 30 suddenly with a black and white decision: be sober and live, continue on and die. And it was that clear. I was in a hospital here in Seattle, and so I chose to try the life part. And one of the things that happens when you get sober is real life comes at you in real time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'd realized and I kind of drank away was I was making money. I was fearful of money. I come from a blue-collar family from Seattle. My dad was a fireman here, and there's eight kids. So you do the math and how we lived, okay?
Yeah.
Money was not something I was used to or knew. I couldn't call a brother or sister and say, my first check, I remember, was for $80,000. I was 22. That might as well have been $1 billion.
Sure.
I don't know what to do with $80,000. And we started making more and more money. And so at 30, I was in the music industry. Of course, you hear all the horror stories of people, artists getting ripped off. And
yeah.
So I'll go to Seattle U and I'll go to business school and I'll figure this out. Well, you can't just go to Seattle U.
I
could go and write a check for tuition. The thing is about that, you have to... have more than a GED to get into Seattle U, I found out. And they want an entrance essay, and they wanted me to go to Seattle Central and get A's, and they chose the classes.
So there's a lot of work to get in.
The hoops.
Now, plus, you hadn't been in school for a long time. You'd lived a very different kind of life. What was it like to all of a sudden be in classes at Seattle U?
It was, I cut all my hair off. I did all these things, and I really changed my not only outward, but I was changing inwardly hugely, I think. So it was fine. You know, the kids that knew who I was there when I was going there, they were really cool. And the classes, frankly, were just too hard for anybody to, hey, dude. And, it was a great experience for me.
But one semester short, you're like, one semester more to go?
Yeah.
You're going to finish that off?
I might have to come back and I might... I actually, this summer, because I've had time to think, I was just going to swear before the think, put in the swear word. I've had time.
Thank you for not.
Yeah. I might go and do that just to finish it. Do I need the last classes? Probably not, but it would be nice to have that.
I want to take you way back for just a moment. In your teens, you were in lots of Seattle bands. I think you at one point said 31, The Farts, 10 Minute Warning, The Veins. You even played drums with the Fastbacks, and then you left for Los Angeles with $380, I think you said. Mm. In retrospect, of course, it was a great move, but when you're driving down there, you certainly didn't know you were going to meet Slash and you were going to be part of Guns N' Roses, one of the biggest bands of the era. What was going through your head? I mean, you were part of a pretty dynamic scene in Seattle at that time. Why did you leave?
Yeah, the dynamic scene in Seattle, however, it was, I mean, amazing musicians and good people, but you must remember this is 1982, 83, 84, and a huge influx of heroin came into our city and just wiped out all of my guys I played with. Not all of them, but a lion's share. My girlfriend, my roommate, and I just, there was that little window I saw. I was 19, and if I don't do it now, whatever that it is, it may never happen. So it's either New York or Los Angeles. My car is a slant six Comet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm pretty sure it was going to make it to L.A. I don't know about New York. So I just headed south. And also at 19, you feel like the world is completely your oyster. You can do anything. I didn't question what was going to happen. I was a single guy by myself. I wasn't afraid. I didn't have to care for anybody else. And so I went and it was very exciting, meeting Slash at a deli and going to his mom's basement, and he played guitar. And we were 19-year-old, 20-year-old kids. I mean, we just, and Izzy moved across the street from me. It wasn't until the five of those original guys that we got into a room one night down in Silver Lake, and we played the first three chords together. I'd been in a bunch of bands.
Sure.
Played with a bunch of different people. There's always that one missing element that in my experience up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that first 5 minutes that the five of us played together that there wasn't a missing element. It was the energy was unmistakable.
Yeah.
And we knew, at least for us, we knew, like, this is the band we've all been looking for. And,
yeah.
And that was it. And we went on our merry way and started writing songs.
Well, of course, international fame afterwards. But also, I mean, Seattle became kind of a center of music after you'd already left. Was part of you, well, it might sound funny to say to a bassist of Guns N' Roses, one of the biggest bands in the world, but was part of you kind of thinking, I kind of wish I was back in Seattle to be part of that thing when it was coming up?
I had, I mean, there was that, dang it, man. I could have just stayed home and been in Soundgarden, you know, or whatever. And Bruce Pabot, who you know,
Sub Pop Records, Bruce, yeah. Pabot,
he and I worked together at Lake Union Cafe on Eastlake before I left. So he was starting Sub Pop. I think he put out his first single, I think Human or whatever the first single was. And I was talking about, well, I got to get out. I'm going to go find a band. And so we both kind of started at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on, he put me on the Singles Club. So I was getting all the, and Kim Warnick worked at Sub Pop. She was with Fastbacks.
Yeah.
And so she sent me the singles, and I was very in touch with what was going on in the growth. And I was really proud, I got to say. I was in a band. We were very active and going, and I wasn't kicking myself for, oh, I should have stayed there. You can't have it all, Duff. Mm-hmm. I realized that at 21. You can't have it all. I had enough mm-hmm. and of good stuff. And I was very proud of, I knew Seattle was always capable of it.
Yeah.
And very proud that the rest of the world finally saw this, the product of this place I kept bragging about down in L.A.
Two final questions. I guess you were often introduced on stage as Duff, King of Beers, McKagan. And is it true that Duff Beer from The Simpsons was named after you?
Yes. And I didn't think it was going to be a big revelation in my book. I thought everybody sort of just knew that or assumed that. And I almost didn't write about it because it just... But it turns out it's a big revelation in my book. But yes, I was known as a beer drinker. Our band became a social sort of phenomenon in 98. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry, 1988. And got a call from this adult cartoon. They wanted to use my name for the beer. They thought it'd be fun. I thought it'd be like college art project.
Yeah.
And you don't know anything about branding when you're 24.
Yeah.
But if I would have had a nickel for the time.
Finally, we're just about out of time, but I got to ask you a question about parenthood. I mean, you're pretty frank in It's So Easy and Other Lies in your memoir.
I've got more questions about parenthood than you could have for me.
Well, I got one question for you about it. It's like your kids, maybe they already have, or someday they're going to read this. They're going to find places where you made some turns that I'm sure you don't want them to take. And the conversation might come up, but Dad, you did it. I mean, have you anticipated why you're going to respond to that?
Well, I hope, like my older daughter, who's turning 15 next week,
yeah.
I hope she does read it, really.
Yeah.
You know, I thought long and hard, and there's plenty of other stuff I didn't write. And she's read, like, the first chapter where her name's in it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then her only comment was, oh, that couple that were kissing, they're no longer together. Like, okay, that's it? Do you want to read the rest? Nah.
The 15-year-old perspective, my party, you stopped writing about my party. I'm not in it.
Yeah, yeah. And
whatever.
For her, it's like, Dad, yeah, yeah, the drugs, the rock, yeah, boring.
Yeah.
For her, it's boring. So as long as it stays boring for a while, but,
yeah.
You know.
Duff McKagan, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks.
The indelible intro to Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. The band evokes Seattle in the 90s, rain and flannel. They got their start on then tiny and now famous Seattle music label Sub Pop Records. The label began as a fanzine and has grown and evolved since the late 1980s. Boys. Mudhoney to the Murder City Devils to Heliosequence, Shabazz Palaces, and Father John Misty, Sub Pop has become the label for dozens and dozens of artists over the decades. Every man wears a symbol. We are at the world headquarters of Sub Pop Records. Megan Jasper, vice president of Sub Pop, is with me. And tell me again who your four-footed friend is.
Well, this is, to my left, is Mr. Vito Pepperoni. He has been one of the few beings that has worked in all of the Sub Pop offices, the terminal sales building, the joint in Belltown down the street, and this building as well.
So this is the third home of Sub Pop.
This is the third home of Sub Pop.
Let's begin here in the lobby.
Okay.
What immediately caught my eye, of course, was this picture over here of this Sub Pop 20th anniversary Thank You Seattle on the top of the Space Needle, kind of looking down. What a great picture. And that was 2008?
It was. So that was July 2008, and Sub Pop was celebrating its 20th anniversary. And we did a few things around town before we had a big two-day festival at Marymore Park. But one of the great things that we did in Seattle was we were taken up to the top of the Space Needle because the top of it had been painted, and those folks were nice enough to put the Sub Pop flag on top of the needle. And I have to tell you that one of the best things I've ever seen in my entire life was seeing that thing waving on top of the needle. It was really a great moment.
What else is here in the lobby area that's noteworthy that you'd like to talk about?
So I would probably mention this original, I believe this is an invoice for the original pressing of Nirvana's Bleach record, and this was for the white vinyl copies, which are super collectible. It seems appropriate that above that invoice is a framed copy of numerous do not deposit insufficient funds checks that we made copies of, because those were also in abundance at the same time.
These were checks that Sub Pop bounced.
They bounced. Can you imagine how high the Sub Pop flag was on top of the Space Needle? Those checks bounced even higher than that.
a tough fiscal time. Well, I'm glad you can kind of just put them on the wall and laugh at them now.
Yeah. It's a good memory to have.
Yeah, a good memory to have. Yeah. You're not bouncing checks anymore.
God, no. I hope not.
After the tour through the offices and the warehouse of Sub Pop, Vice President Megan Jasper told me about the early days at the label.
It was the end of 1989. We were working with Nirvana and The Fluid and Mudhoney. Mudhoney was about to release their self-titled record, which did so well. And Nirvana were building up so much steam. And the Reverend Horton Heat was just about to sign to Sub Pop. And just so many exciting things.
It's one thing to be around musicians and around a creative scene. But what was happening in Seattle at that time became national, became international,
right.
Became gigantic. What was it like to kind of see that exploding all around you?
It was absolutely surreal because, you know, when something is building and you're in the midst of it, let alone at the epicenter of it, you don't have a perspective because you're in the middle of it. We just knew that people had given this thing a name and that it was affecting people's lives in some interesting ways, in some great ways, in some sad ways. And
what sad ways?
Well, a couple of things. One is Seattle was such an intimate, close, small community of people as far as the music scene went. And when there's a lot of attention that's being given to a neighborhood or a city or a scene, it opens it up and it allows for people to want to move there or to visit. And all of those things, they're both a blessing and a curse. You know, they can create more opportunities, but they also take away from that pure thing that felt really, really special. And whatever that thing is becomes diluted in the process. There are people who maybe would go out to shows regularly and all of a sudden didn't feel comfortable going to shows because they were in bands and they didn't want to be bothered or felt like they were something that they didn't feel like they were, a rock star. Or they just lost that feeling of knowing everyone who was at a show that their friend's band was playing.
So what they called grunge was blowing up, Nevermind was blowing up,
yeah.
And you're the receptionist at Sub Pop, and you get a phone call one day, and it's from the New York Times, and they wanted to talk to you about what this thing was. Tell us a little bit about that conversation.
I was lucky enough to get a job for Sub Pop's distribution company, Caroline Records, and I worked as the Northwest salesperson for Caroline, and I was in my apartment. I can't even tell you how many pots of coffee I had had that morning, a lot. And Jonathan called me and said, oh, you might get a call from the New York Times. They tried calling me, and I just felt like you were the better person to talk to. And so my phone rang, and I thought, oh, this will be fun. It will break up my day. And there was a reporter who was super, super nice, and he wanted to know what words people who loved grunge used. And of course, you know, come on. It's not like there really was this secret language or lexicon. But I thought, well, I'll just have some fun, and the conversation will end in a hearty laugh, and we'll both go on and have our days. And but that laugh never came. I asked him to give me words, and I would give him the grunge translation. I think he asked for articles of clothing, and so I said boots were kickers, and sweaters were, I think I said something fuzz, I can't remember. And then I thought, this is sounding too believable. I'll throw in some weird things to kind of throw it off. And that was Cobnobbler, which I think was a loser or something. I can't even remember, to be honest. And then that wasn't being questioned, and I was like, ugh. All right. So then I went super goofy and said, you know, how about swinging on the flippity-flop? That's what we say for, you know, toodaloo. And that, you know, still no, like, come on.
It ended up in the paper, right? It's the lexicon of grunge.
Yes, and I think you will appreciate that days later, I had totally forgotten about this, and then all of a sudden my mom called. My mom and I talk a lot on the phone, and she, in her perfect Worcester accent, said, holy sh, you're not going to believe this. You need to run down to 7-Eleven right now and pick up a New York Times. And so, like a good girl, I pulled my shit together and ran down to 7-Eleven, and I picked up a New York Times, and I could not believe what I saw, and I called my mom back, and she was like, this is fabulous. And I thought, you know, this is, it's a pretty good life when you can lie and get away with it and receive praise from your mom.
Now, of course, the New York Times is famous for their corrections. They correct every little error. Did they ever, like, do a correction and go, sorry, these were just kind of made up and we were being put on?
I don't think they ever did that. What happened was, I would say maybe a month or 2 months later, the Baffler had called me and they said, we know this is a joke. And I said, well, you know, of course it's a joke. I would say maybe a couple of weeks after that, I received a phone call from one of the editors at the New York Times, kind of coming down on me for lying, but then telling me that they printed it tongue in cheek. And I thought, well, then why are you upset with me? And then they asked where they could pick up shirts with the lexicon of grunge. And I thought, nah, there you go.
So you were here in 89, and you've talked a little bit about how the scene changed around people in good ways and in bad ways. When you think about, if you just kind of telescope the experience, 1989, mm-hmm. 2012, uh-huh. kind of think about, talk a little bit about the differences or maybe even the similarities at Sub Pop in, over that long stretch.
I think that some things that are very similar that still exist in Seattle music today is actually that sense of intimacy. This is a city, but it's a small enough community where actually we all know each other very, very well. And a lot of us can do interesting things because of that.
I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Sweat, be your cardigan. The musicians. Sweat, be your cardigan.